Acts 9:29. And he, that would be Saul, the apostle Paul, spake boldly in the name of the Lord Jesus, and disputed against the Grecians, but they went about to slay him, which, when the brethren knew, they brought him down to Caesarea, and sent him forth to Tarsus. Then had the churches rest throughout all Judea and Galilee and Samaria, and were edified. And walking in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Ghost were multiplied. We looked at these verses on Sunday. And we saw, starting in verse 20, that after Paul's conversion, he was against the church, wanting to destroy believers. He had gotten a permission slip to travel from Jerusalem to Damascus to imprison, to kill Christians. But on the way, a light shone into his heart, and he was enlightened to the reality of Jesus Christ. And it says there in verse 20, after his conversion, that straight away he began to preach the gospel. And they were amazed at what he had to say. They were confounded by his words, but there was no fruit there. In fact, there in Damascus, they wanted to kill him. And so he had to get out of there, hightail it out, and he goes over to Jerusalem. Once again, speaking boldly, zealous for the faith, proclaiming Jesus Christ, but once again, there's no fruit. It leads to unrest in the church, causes problems for the church, so much so that they have to send Saul away. Lots of zeal, lots of go for it, but no fruit from this time. And I had to ask myself, why is that? All this zeal, all this passion, and yet there's no fruit. Why? I read a story, or a study rather, yesterday, done by Professor Galinsky of Stanford University. And they took these volunteers, these student volunteers from Stanford University, and they asked them a series of questions to separate the two groups. They were looking for people, folks that were very passionate, very power-hungry, very go-for-it mentality. Guys that just were really consumed with themselves, gals that were consumed with themselves. And they asked questions to divide these two groups up. They have these, whatever they are, psychological tests that you take and you answer questions, and they word them different ways to really figure out, get into your head, I guess. So they grouped these two groups. They had them figured out. Power-hungry people, and then those that were more concerned with others and opinions of others and how other people were doing. And then they took this study, and they simply had these two groups. They didn't know that they were grouped anyway. They had them take a felt tip marker and draw a capital letter E on their forehead. You got to know scientists have a sense of humor. So all these students took these felt tip markers and marked a big E on their forehead. And what they found out was fascinating. They did all these tests, did all this stuff to figure out, you know, what they were into and the power and all that kind of stuff. What they found was the way that a person wrote the E on their head told them more about their personality than anything else. If there's two ways you can write an E on your forehead. You can write a capital E on your forehead so that if you look in the mirror, you can read it. Or you can write an E on your forehead in such a way that other people, when they look at you, they can read it. If you wrote a capital E on your forehead so that you could read it in a mirror, you're a power-hungry individual, according to this study. If you wrote an E on your head so that other people could read it, then you were a person that cared for others and the opinions of other people. So there's a bunch of people running around Stanford University for a couple days with these big E's on their head. You guys are thinking right now, which way would I write it? Am I power hungry? And what was interesting to me was this professor's evaluation of this group that was power hungry, all about themselves. He said this, what characterized this group of people is they were like a powerful sports car with a big gas pedal but no steering wheel. It was just go, 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 me, me, me. But they were unable to steer themselves. And they would have issues and have collisions. That to me is a perfect description of the apostle, or Saul, later to become the apostle Paul, in Acts chapter 9. It's all about me, really, if you look at it. In Acts 22, we'll get there shortly. He argues with God. I'm the man. I'm the one for this ministry. Don't send me away. I've got to be used here in this ministry. It was all about me, all about him, all about Saul. And so he had to be sent away for 10 years to figure out, no, it's not, Paul. It's all about me, God would say. It's my plan, and unless you learn to be steered, unless you learn to go with my direction, I can't use you, no matter how talented, no matter how gifted you are. So he spent 10 years getting a steering wheel, I believe. And when he left, it says, the churches had rest. There are people that are zealous today. And I use the word zeal in a certain sense here. Zeal, like Saul, kind of go for it, kind of my way or the highway type of people. And what I've seen is that mentality can be very counterproductive. Perhaps you've seen on the news, it's been all over the place, a pastor, Fred Phelps. Have you heard that name? He's the pastor of a Baptist church in Kansas called Westboro Baptist Church. And he gained notoriety in the late 80s and 90s with a certain website he put out that said GodHatesFags.com. And he's this pastor, and he preached that from the pulpit. And they had zeal for this, and they had, you know, passion for that. But soon they found that wasn't enough. And so lately, he's regained the spotlight because now his followers, there's about 50 of them, they take their money. They fly all over the United States following funerals of servicemen coming back from Iraq. And they stand out in front of those funerals with these signs that say, you're going to hell. Your son is in hell. God hates America. God hates you. Right out there in front of them. In fact, Congress passed a law that they cannot now be within 250 feet or something of funerals. It was causing so much problems. It's zeal. It's that crazy kind of mentality, that crazy kind of off-kilter zeal. It's my way or the highway. You've got to do it this way. And what happens is it's counterproductive. The churches were suffering because of Paul right here. He thought in his own mind, I'm doing good. I'm helping out. I'm preaching the gospel. But in actuality, he was causing the church to have unrest. It's like Pastor Fred Phelps. In his own mind, he's right. Everyone's wrong. But he's being counterproductive. He is harming the church by his attitude. It's a zeal. It's this unchecked zeal. He's one of those guys that saying is so right. There are some people that bring peace wherever they go. And there are some people that bring peace when they go. That was Saul in this case. That's a Pastor Fred Phelps. That's individuals that are, this is the way it has to be. Counterproductive. There's another word that I think better describes how we're to be as Christians. Not zeal. Zeal without knowledge, all those things. But there's another word. It's called enthusiasm. I like to see enthusiastic Christians. What's enthusiasm? It comes from two Greek words. The first Greek word, en, which means in. And then theos, which means God. Enthusiasm, the very root of it, means to be into God. That's it. And I believe Paul, in his 10 years in Tarsus, took zeal and it became enthusiasm. He became into God, steered by God. Because he would say, in Galatians 2:20, he would say, this is my deal. Where I'm at now, Galatians 2:20. He says, I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet not I live, but Christ lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by the power of the Son of God who loved me and died for me. That's the life he lived. He was enthusiastic from that point on, into God, directed by God, steered by God from then on. He was zealous. Undirected. Gas without a steering wheel. But then God got a hold of him after 10 years in Tarsus. And he became a guy that was sensitive to God's Spirit. And this is what I have to do so often in my life. There are times when I get into the flesh, where it's go, 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 I got to do it this way. And quite often when I'm feeling that way, when it's all gas, quite often it's me. I have to slow down so often and pray, Lord, is this really what you want me to be doing? Is this really how you want me to speak to him, speak to her? Is this really the attitude that I should have? And quite often I'll find, no, slow down. Talk to me. And now I can steer you. Now I can get you in the right direction. It's not about you, Matt. It's about me. And the way I find out God's direction is by slowing down and talking with him. All right, Lord, now direct me. And then I'm enthusiastic instead of zealous. Then I'm productive rather than counterproductive like Saul. He figured it out, though. So now we leave Saul and we pick back up with Peter. Peter will carry us through to chapter 12, essentially. So Peter comes on the scene here. And in these few verses that end this chapter, I believe we see some very neat insights on why Peter was so powerful in the book of Acts. We see into this guy, his mentality, what made him tick here. In Acts chapter 9, check it out, verse 32. And it came to pass, as Peter passed throughout all the quarters, he came down also to the saints which dwelt at Lydda. And there he found a certain man named Annas, which had kept his bed 8 years and was sick of the palsy. And Peter said unto him, Annas, Jesus Christ, Christ makes thee whole. Arise and make your bed. And he arose immediately. Now that's powerful. That's power. That's the kind of power that I would love to have. To be able to march into my girl's room and say, arise and make your bed. I don't have it yet. Peter says it. This man jumps up, makes his bed. And all that dwelt at Lydda and Sharon saw him and turned to the Lord. The first thing I see with Peter here, number one, hint, tip, is he was number one with the people. Now check it out. This is Pastor Peter. 10 years have gone by since Acts chapter 2, since Pentecost. The church there at Jerusalem that he was in charge of would probably number anywhere between 25 and 50,000 people. The first mega church. He was as successful as anyone has ever been in the history of Christianity up to that point. He was the man, Pastor Pete. 10 years, successful, had done it. So now, what is he doing? 10 years into it, what's he doing with himself? People wonder, you know, what do pastors do? What's Pete doing? Is he out playing a round of golf? Nothing wrong with golf. Is he showing up on Larry King Live to do interviews? Is he, even worse, taking vacations to Maui? What's he doing with himself? What's he doing? Well, what we find Pete doing is, he's out visiting people. Something any one of us can do. A very normal activity. A gal came up to me the Sunday before I left, 2 Sundays ago, And she said, "Pastor Matt." I looked at her, "Yeah." She said, "I saw you in the return line at Walmart." And I'm wondering, should I repent right now? That was definitely a stressful situation. And she said, "I couldn't believe it. You do normal things too." Yep. I do normal things. I said, "I'm as normal as anybody. Although when I'm in Walmart, I feel like I landed in a strange planet, but I do normal things." "You're a normal guy." "Absolutely." And here, Pastor Peter is giving to you and me one of the great insights, I believe, into ministry. You want ministry to open up for you? Be with the people. Here he is, the big guy in Christianity. You name the biggest guy in Christianity, he was it. Billy Graham, whoever it was, Peter's it. What's he doing? He's down. It doesn't say he's visiting the church. It says he's visiting the saints. He's not going to these big packed out churches and giving big teachings. Nothing wrong with that. He's visiting individual saints. Not in Rome or Athens or Jerusalem, in this city called Lydda, a little podunk town. Going around, just visiting individuals, talking with them. And it opens up into this radical ministry, this revival here in this city. Started with him just simply being, hanging out with the people. I love that. Any one of us can do that. What I've found is when I'm with people, ministry just happens. It just does. Needs come up. Ideas are talked about, are discussed. Salvation occurs when you're simply with people. And I was really blessed yesterday morning. I got together with a group of eight. And they reiterated to me, to that group, that if you don't know, the G8 is the group of four pastors and four elders that kind of make the decisions for the vision and financial decisions and those things at Edgewater Christian Fellowship. These guys said, "You know what? We're here to serve the people. We're here to be with the people. We're here to help out in any way possible." And that blessed me because that's the heart of, I believe, Pastor Pete. That's where ministry begins, just being with people, hanging out with them. That's all Pete does here. Well, how would he know that? Because Jesus had told him that in Matthew 20. He said, "Pete, disciples, you want to be great in the kingdom? Then learn to serve. Be with the people. Hang out with them. And watch and see ministry happen." That's the first thing I see with Pastor Pete. He was with the people. Secondly, now he has this miracle. Revival sparks out. People are turning to the Lord. Now, verse 36. "There was at Joppa a certain disciple named Tabitha, which by interpretation is called Dorcas," or her nickname was Dorcas. Now, that wouldn't be a nickname I would choose, but it actually means gazelle or gracious. It's a good nickname. Today, she would be teased to no end. But back then, this was a nickname that would mean gracious or gazelle or fleet. It's a positive, good thing. And this woman was full of good works and alms deeds which she did. And it came to pass in those days that she was sick and died. Whom, when they had washed, they laid her in an upper chamber. And for so much as Lydda was near to Joppa, and the disciples had heard that Peter was there, they sent unto him two men desiring that he would not delay to come to them. Then Peter arose and went with them." First thing I see with Pete, he's just with the people. Second thing I see with Pete is he's willing to be interrupted. There's a big revival there in Lydda, in Sharon. I'm sure he was busy teaching, discipling these people that had just received salvation. And then along comes these two people. "Hey, come over here to this woman that died." He didn't know her. As we'll see, they had to explain what she had done to Peter. "Come over here and deal with this. She died." Pete didn't say, "Well, you know, let me check my day planner. Talk to my secretary." No. He dropped what he was doing, verse 39, and he arose and went with them. He was willing to be interrupted. I'm finding more and more and more and more interruptions are divine. Interruptions are quite often the way God gets me involved in ministry. It happened to me just on Monday. Monday was my wife and I were our seventh anniversary. And so we went to grab a bite to eat. And we decided we'd stay in Grants Pass, which is a mistake because nothing is open on Monday. So we had called these restaurants. Nothing was open. So we ended up at this restaurant we'd never been at. Nobody was in there. Just us. And we're eating some food, and I noticed the guy that had helped us turned out to be the owner of the restaurant. I could tell he was from another country, and I was pretty sure he was Chinese. So I just asked him, kind of as he was passing by, "Hey, are you from China?" "Yeah." So we started talking a little bit about China, and I just wanted to have a quick conversation with him. Well, he kind of parked himself right there. And he's leaning against our table, and he just starts talking about he'd been to New York and San Francisco and Wisconsin and all these places, and I'm sitting there mid-bite. "Uh-huh. Okay." And he just kept on going. I wanted to have a conversation with my wife. You know, it's the anniversary. And so to kind of close the conversation, I said, what's your name, buddy? What's your name?" And he says, "My?" And I said, yeah, your name." He said, "My." I said, "Right. What's your name?" He said, "My." And then my wife says, "Right, we're wondering what your name is." And he says, "My, M-A-I. I said, "Oh, my." To make a long story short, my wife invites him to church. He goes, "Wow, you know, he's been in the States for 12 years. I've never been to a church." And he had these just classic questions, things you don't even think of that a foreigner would have. Just, you know, they totally blow your mind, these questions he's asking. And we're answering them. And I said, "Well, I'll come pick you up if you want to come." He doesn't know I'm the pastor. So I said, "Okay, 11 o'clock. I can't make the 9 o'clock service, but I can make the 11 o'clock service." So he wants to come here. He's really excited about what's happening here. Interruptions, if you'll let them, can quite often be the road to ministry. Here, Pete gets interrupted. "Hey, I know there's a revival here. I know this miracle has led to great things, but come over here, join with us." He does it. Another revival sparks, as we'll see. Interruptions, if you let them, if you allow God to lead you that way, can quite often lead to ministry. Does for Pete. So they arose and went with them. And when he was come, verse 39, they brought him into the upper chamber. And all the widows stood by weeping and showing the coats and garments which Dorcas made while she was with them. Quick side note. They're bummed. This lady, Dorcas, she died. We cared for her. Why? Why did they care for her? Because of the sermons she preached? Because of the theology she brought? No. Because of the practical care she showed. "Look at these coats. Look at these garments that she made for us. Check them out." They're showing them to Pete. "We can't lose her. We've got to have her." Lifting up the things that she had made for Peter to see how important Dorcas was to them. I had to ask myself, if I died and people were at my funeral, what would they hold up? "This is what, you know, Matt did for me. Here it is, this notebook. That's what it is. There's a few notes in it, and there's a few drool spots where I fell asleep." That, you know, what would they hold up for me? It's a great question to ask yourself. If you died, what would people hold up at your funeral? What would they say? "This is how he or she ministered to me. This is what that person meant to me." It's that whole idea of living your life backwards. What would they do? What would they do for me? How am I affecting people? Dorcas was so effective that they said, "We can't lose her," because she practically served with love. Not sermons, not theology, coats, blankets, food. Those are the things that people remember. I'm convinced of it. Practical meeting of needs. I was hungry. That guy took me out to lunch. I needed a coat, and that guy just gave me his coat. My car was broken. That guy came over and he fixed it. That's what people remember. Sermons, there's so many of them. We forget them. I want to be more of a dork in my life. I want to be more of a guy that meets practical needs for people. That's what's remembered. That's why they loved her. And so they hold it up. And then we come to reason number three, or tip number three, why Pete moved so powerfully in ministry. But verse 40, Peter put them all forth and kneeled down and prayed. And turning him to the body said, Tabitha, arise. And she opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up. And he gave her his hand and lifted her up. And when she had called the saints and widows, presented her alive. Number three. Not just with the people, not only willing to be interrupted, but number three, he worked like Jesus Christ. This story should ring a bell in your mind. Acts chapter 9. Because it is very similar to a story found in Mark chapter 5, verse 41. There's another girl who had died in Mark chapter 5. Jesus is called. Hey, this girl died. So Jesus almost Peter does almost the exact same thing Jesus did back there in Mark chapter 5, verse 41 and 42. Jesus put out everybody else. Let Peter and John come in with him. Put everybody else. That's the same thing Pete does here. He put them all out. I thought he put them out because he'd be embarrassed if he said to her, hey, get up, and she didn't. He could still walk out. No problem. I don't know. She's dead. Sorry. But Jesus did the same thing. Put out those people. Peter does the same. Jesus says to this girl, Talitha kumi in the original language, which means damsel, arise. Peter, in the original language, Greek, says Tabitha kumi, similar words. Jesus grabs her hand and lifts her up. Peter grabs her hand and lifts her up. Jesus presents her to the people. Peter presents her to the people. Step by step, he does the same thing as Jesus Christ. He worked like Jesus Christ. I'm loving being in the book of Acts, studying through it. I love to learn from Paul through the epistles. Wonderful. But here's the deal. We are to live like Jesus Christ. We can love Peter and we can learn from Paul, but we're to live like Jesus Christ. And just recently, in fact, in Maui, I started reading through the Gospels. And it has been so refreshing for me to see the example given by Jesus Christ. He's our example. He's the one we model ourselves after. He's the one that we want to be like. Not Peter necessarily, not Paul. We can learn from them. We can enjoy them. But our model is Jesus Christ. And let me suggest to you, wherever you're at, in your studies, in your devotions, to always bounce into the Gospels. Read a chapter here or there. Always keep a finger in the Gospels because we are to be little Christs. That's what Christian means. We're to be like Jesus Christ. Not like Paul necessarily. We can learn from him. Not like Peter. Great example here in our story. But we're to have as our example Jesus Christ. And Peter here understood that. Says, I'm going to do ministry like Jesus Christ did. It's radical. It's refreshing. So he's with the people. That led to ministry. Willing to be interrupted led to revival. Work like Jesus Christ led to this miracle. And then finally, finishing up this chapter, and it was known throughout all Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. And it came to pass that he tarried many days in Joppa with one Simon, a tanner. Fourthly, and finally, he was willing to change. He was willing to change. He stays, verse 43 tells us, with a guy known as Simon the Tanner. Of all the places he could have stayed there in Joppa, he decides to stay with a tanner. Big deal. Well, as you know, a tanner is a guy that takes animal hides and cures them and makes leather out of them. That was, at this time, the worst job an individual could have. Why is that? The law said, if you touch dead animals, if you touch dead things, you are ceremonially unclean for 24 hours. So every day this guy would go to work, he was unclean till the next day. So looked down upon were tanners that the Mishnah, what's that? It's the commentary written on the Old Testament, on the law. The Mishnah said this, if a gal got married to a man and he had hid from her that he was a tanner, or if later on he got a job as a tanner, that was legal grounds for a divorce. You can get divorced. I don't like that job. You're touching dead animals. Or I believe in PETA, whatever it may be. Peter would know that. Peter would be brought up underneath that understanding. And yet, he goes and he stays with this man. If you were in his house, you would be unclean like him as well. You would be considered ceremonially unclean just like the tanner because you're in his house. Yet he's willing to change, which is huge, we'll see in chapter 10. Because that's a little baby step. There's a radical explosion waiting for Peter in chapter 10. A shock of his life that he would never have been able to handle in ministry if he wasn't willing to change, if he wasn't flexible, if he wasn't staying at a tanner's house. I believe, personally, one of the keys to success in the kingdom of God is flexibility. I've shared before there in Jeremiah chapter 18. Jeremiah is told by God, go down to the potter and watch him make pottery. And so Jeremiah goes down there, watches him make pottery, and one of the vessels is marred. It has a scar in it. And so that potter pushes it back together and reforms it, remakes it. And God has a commentary on that. He says, that's like you. That clay, which we're made from the clay, we're made from the ground, we're made from the earth. And all of us, no matter who we are, we're flawed. We have this flaw called sin, inherited from Adam. And so God has to reform us, remake us. It's a perfect picture of salvation. But if you think about clay, what's the one quality that clay requires? Is it strength? Nope. The firing process will give it strength. Is it color? Charisma? Nope. You can add glaze and add color to it. There's one quality clay has to have. If it's not flexible, if it's not moldable, then you dispose of it. You throw it away because you can't form it into what is desired. Peter, Paul as well, exemplified in their lives flexibility. Flexible to what God wanted to do through them. We'll see that is a necessity in chapter 10. Peter's got to be flexible. I've got to be flexible. My ways, God says, are higher than your ways. As high as the heavens are above the earth, so high are my ways above yours. We've got to be flexible. All right, Lord. All right, Lord. I'm willing to be reshaped, remade in your image. It's a key. I think it took 10 years for Paul to get that in Tarsus. And tonight, I want us to take communion together. Because communion to me is one of those ways that we get conformed to Jesus Christ. You take the body, broken. Broken for the flaw that's in us. The reason Christ's body was broken is because we are flawed, because we have sin. And you partake of that body. And it's not just one calorie. Jesus says, take, eat, this is my body. Something happens in communion. You partake in the divine. You take in of Jesus Christ. And then you get the cup. No matter where we've blown it, no matter how we've been inflexible, no matter how we've been zealous and harmed the church, no problem, God says. I can forgive you, and I can turn it for good. I alone can do that. So we're going to turn down the lights. Mark's going to come up, sing a couple of songs. Feel free to come up whenever you feel like it to take communion. And may I suggest praying, Lord, if I'm on the spinning wheel right now, if things feel like they're whirling around, going round and round and round, Lord, mold me. I'm flawed. I realize that. Fix it. Remake me in your image. And watch him do that tonight through the elements, this week, as you continue to seek his face. Amen.